touch the ground. The priest's back was to him, and he was already bending over the rope, touching the edge of the knife to the braided twine, starting to saw back and forth.
"No!"
Henry shouted, lowering his shoulder just as the man turned toward him and, "Oh!" of surprise forming on his lips. Corona's positioning was such that he was off balance when Henry collided with him, his feet tangling as he was shoved backward. The knife flew from his hands, soaring end over end, its blade glinting in the sunlight. It vanished into the hole, and a terrifying image of his mother with a knife stuck into her head burst through Henry's mind. But that dark thought was quickly washed away by a very real image, Corona rolling, a mess of arms and legs, sliding over the edge of the hole, reaching out desperately, his eyes huge and white and full of fear. Henry dove, his hand outstretched, grabbing for the priest's fingers, and catching them, squeezing as tightly as he could, his joints popping under the man's weight and the pull of gravity into the hole. Henry gritted his teeth as he stared down at the man who'd just tried to kill his mother. The man stared back, and then smiled. His hair was dangling into the hole, half swallowed by the darkness.
"My time here is finished, and you, child, have passed the test. May absence bless the fate of the Four Kingdoms while Tarragon falls into squalor."
Henry realized too late what the man was planning to do. Corona yanked his sweaty hand from Henry's grasp and seemed to hang in the air for an impossible moment, that strangely peaceful smile plastered across his face. And then he fell into darkness without a sound. Henry toppled backward, clutching his arm, gasping for breath.
"Froth," he thought. "Did that really just happen?"
His world, which had always been an unusual one, now seemed sheathed in a thick armor of madness. Then he remembered. The rope. Ignoring the pain shooting through his shoulder and arm, he launched himself at the only thing saving his mother from the same fate that befell the priest. Before Henry had tackled Corona, the priest had managed to slice through a good portion of the rope, and now, thread by thread, it was snapping free of the hook, gaining momentum with each passing second. It sprang free, and once more Henry had to dive, grabbing the end with his uninjured hand, holding tight, digging his feet into the dirt as he was dragged toward the hole.
"I'm going to die," he thought.
But then one of his feet hooked on the metal implement, stuck in the ground. He dug his toes into the iron circle, refusing to let them slip free. On the other end of the rope, he felt a tug, then another. His mother, asking to be pulled up.
"I don't have the strength, Mother,"
he tried to say. But his voice and his heart were both trapped in his throat, throbbing through his skin. All he could do was hang on, even as the rope burned his fingers and the metal hook bit into his toes, threatening to break them one by one. He hung on while the sun fell from the sky, vanishing from sight, and the dueling moons, one red, one green, rose on each side, glowing chariots charging toward each other in the dark. Countless stars of red, green, and gold burst into being, surrounding the two moons, seeming to spur them on. One of Henry's fingers lost all strength and released its hold, adding to the burden of the others. Another finger gave out. Then a third. Numb, his thumb and forefinger held on for as long as they could, far longer than Henry would have ever thought possible. They too, however, ran out of strength.
"I'm sorry, Mother. I have failed you."
Henry released the rope, which immediately darted away from him like an injured snake. He watched it slide into the hole and disappear. Before being replaced by a hand, with pale, spindly fingers curling over the edge, finding purchase on the rocky ground. Henry stared, unbelieving. Another hand, then a set of arms, and then his mother's face, blazing with an unnatural light as if lit from within, bursting with an inhumanly radiance usually only seen in the moon or the stars.
"Mother?"
Henry rasped.
"How?"
"Sweetness," she said, kneeling over him.
"You saved me. You saved us all. I was too weak. You were stronger than anyone else could have been. You gave me the time I needed,
It spoke to me.
Henry was bone-weary and just wanted to sleep, but curiosity got the better of him.
Who?
He asked.
Absence. Wrath. The god of many names. The One. I know the words. The words are me, and I am the words. My greatest desire has been fulfilled. I am going to change everything.
3 days after his mother's death, Henry was changing. At first the changes were subtle. A few whiskers sprouted from his chin, dark and thick. Camped to the east of Night's End, he played with them with his fingers.
I am a man,
he thought, and then laughed. If a few scraggly chin hairs made him a man, then a donkey was the same as a stallion. Still, there was no mistaking the way his arms and legs had changed, too. Only a few days earlier they were as straight and narrow as bean poles. Now, if the sunlight hit his skin just right, there was a shape to them.
Muscle, he thought,
flexing his bicep, all shiny and new. If the boys back home saw him, they would still mock him, but he didn't care. He might never see them again. After speaking with his mother, his dead mother, he'd known what to do. He'd taken his only possession of value, his boots, back to Vaughan's shop. He traded them in for a much more modest pair and collected the difference in value in silver stallions. As he'd walked through Night's End, people stared at him. He was almost as notorious as his mother by association. He'd given them no mind, however, ignoring their jeers and attempts to trip him. Thankfully, none had directly assaulted him, and now he wondered if it was fear of his mother, even in death, that stayed their hands. There was nothing left for him in Night's End, and he wouldn't go back. He didn't know where he would go, only that he needed to get as far away as possible and make his own way in the world. He was small and underdeveloped for his age, yes, but his mother had taught him much, and he wouldn't waste that knowledge. So he'd collected supplies using what coin he had, and set off from the city. That was 3 days ago. He'd avoided the busy western road, instead cutting a path across the empty countryside, sleeping under the red, green, and gold stars, and enjoying the mild spring weather. Roth's Tears, the fortnight-long rainy season, was well behind him. Each night he tried to make contact with his mother again, to no avail. He didn't let it get him down, not yet. Instead, he took it as a sign that he was making the right choices and no longer in need of her guidance. Now, as the morning light crept across the lush western plains, Henry removed his shirt to study his chest.
"Aye!"
he screamed, peering at his skin. The day before he'd noticed black specks. At first he'd thought they were dirt, but when he'd tried to scrub them away, they refused to budge. Today they sprouted from dozens of spots in his skin, a fine layer of hair from the top of his chest all the way to his navel. The topography of his chest looked different, too. Less flat, harder and more pronounced. He flexed again, chuckling when the muscles beneath his skin responded, fluttering. Did one always become a man so quickly? He wondered to himself. Although he wanted the answer to be yes, he knew in his heart there was more to the changes wrought on his body in just a few short days since he'd last seen his mother. Her chanted words seemed to haunt his steps, like dark shadows closing in.
Their hearts will fail, their lives will end, but yours will last. It will extend beyond all measure on land or sea, from skin to skin, from teeth to teeth. Whose lives will end? He wondered now. And how will mine extend? Fang of wolf and fur of bear, to warm, to change, to save, to tear. A climb to the mount, a jaunt through the wood, their fates will be yours, to help them is good. Help who? Mother, are you there? Help who? The fate marked? What does that even mean?
As usual, the only response he received was the chirping of prairie birds and the rustling of long grass. He sighed. Suddenly the tiny hairs on his chest and face didn't mean so much. not without her. He wanted to cry, but the tears wouldn't come. It was as if he'd emptied out his reservoirs, and there was nothing left to refill them with. "Men don't cry," he said aloud, to comfort himself. He packed up his camp and walked on, in no particular direction. Little did he know, his feet were guided by a force more powerful than any the world had ever known. 3 years earlier. When they returned to Night's End, everything was the same and yet entirely different. In a way, the sameness was a comfort, even when Henry's peers, who'd all grown even taller and bigger in the few months Henry had been away, while he'd hardly grown at all, gave him a swift beating. He'd even smiled as he'd wiped the blood from his nose. He was home. That was all that mattered. And yet so much had changed. Not Night's End, but his mother's place in it. At first she was the lost fury returned, bringing words of wisdom from an ancient people who were known for their devotion to their own deity. But soon she began to share the words she had spoken in the dark, the words Henry had written on hundreds of sheaves of parchment. Her prophecies. She spoke of war, of arrogant rulers across all four kingdoms, of unrighteousness, of the coming of infants marked with ancient powers. The king denounced her position as one of the three, and his decision was quickly confirmed by the other furies. Shamed, cast off, his mother should have faded away. In fact, Henry tried to convince her to leave the city that no longer loved her. She refused. Instead, she took to standing on walls and steps, speaking to the people, trying to convince them of what was to come, trying to persuade them that soon the world would have need of those bearing what she called fate marks, strange birthmarks that would give the bearers great powers, the power to choose good over evil, the power to change the world, to right its course, to bring about peace. The people threw rocks at her. Henry couldn't leave the house. Nor would his mother let him. For a while, that was the worst of it, until his mother began speaking out against the Furia and the three who led them. Her next target was the king, who, she said, was leading the West into darkness. Charges were levied, a trial held. She was convicted of all charges, including treason. 3 weeks after his mother's death, Henry's powerful legs churned beneath him, propelling him forward, a breath of cold air washing over his skin. He could sense the fear slashing through his prey, a white-tailed elk with a beautiful six-pointed rack of antlers atop its head, sitting like a dark crown of bone. It was strange. He could hear the animal's heart beating and the rush of blood through its veins as he closed in. It darted left, but he was already moving in that direction, anticipating the maneuver. He took two more long strides, and then pushed off, throwing his body into the air. The elk glanced back and released a squeal. Henry landed atop its back, extending his muscly arms and wrapping his strong fingers around the beast's neck, snapping it with a deft jerk of his hands. He landed hard on the animal as it collapsed, dead. He rolled off the dead elk, looking away, breathing, just breathing. He felt desire, temptation, the urge to bare his teeth and rip into the animal's flesh, to tear and grind. The feeling scared him more than anything, and yet felt completely natural, a contradiction he was still trying to make sense of. He watched his breaths take shape in the form of vaporous ghosts soaring overhead. As he'd moved northwest, the weather had grown colder and colder. Having not planned to travel northward, Henry was woefully underprepared for the drastic change in temperature, his breeches and long-sleeved shirt thin and full of holes and already stretched beyond its limits, tearing in places. But Henry wasn't the least bit cold. In fact, he seemed to grow warmer as the temperature dropped. His skin was now covered by a tangled layer of dark hair, curly and thick. It coated his cheeks and chin. It sprouted from the neckline of his shirt. When he removed his clothes to bathe in a pond or stream, it was everywhere. Somewhere beneath the hair were bulging muscles and thick bones, though he couldn't see them anymore. He could feel them, however. and Henry still felt as if it was somebody else's body rather than his own, which was supposed to be skinny and weak and prone to fatigue. Now his body never seemed to tire. There was no doubt in his mind any more. His mother had done something to him with her strange poem, when her eyes were rolled back in her head. She had changed him somehow, inexplicably. He was faster, stronger, even taller. Though he'd run out of supplies a week ago, he had no problem catching game on the prairie lands. "I am a killer," he thought now, as he stared at the mountains looming to the north. Due to his weak stomach, back in Night's End, he couldn't have stood to watch a butcher do his grisly work. Now he was doing far worse, and enjoying it. "What am I, Mother? What have you turned me into?" He couldn't hold back any longer, twisting his body and sinking his two sharp teeth into the elk's hide, ripping away a layer of skin and burrowing his way into the raw meat, blood spurting onto his lips, dripping from his chin. The sight of blood used to make him nauseous. Now it only spurred him on. He didn't stop until his hunger was satisfied. Henry took what was left of the meat and tied it to his back, once more moving in the direction of the mournful mountains. Though he knew the animal was heavy, he barely felt the weight. As he walked, his feet caught his eye. They were at least twice as long and wide as they'd been when he first departed Night's End. A week ago he'd been forced to cast his boots aside when they grew too small, bursting at the seams. The hair that grew on top reminded him of... "Roth, did I really just have such a thought? I'm a man, a human, not some wild beast. Right?"
"I have fur," Henry said aloud,
cringing at the sound of his own voice, which was too deep, too rough, a rumble originating from somewhere deep in his chest. It was the voice of a stranger.
"It's just hair,"
he immediately thought, vanquishing his dark feelings.
"And it's my voice. I've become a man, that is all. Mother helped me become a man."
Around midday, Henry reached a pass through the mountains, a frozen river cutting between the cliffs.
"Raider's Pass," he thought.
The pass's history was well known, the stories of valor, victory, and defeat sung by famous bards across the Four Kingdoms. Henry wondered how much blood had been spilled into the river, washing all the way to the burning sea. Sighing, he slung down his load. Using the elk's thickest antler, he chipped away at the ice until he was able to reach the stream beneath. He drank, relishing how the icy water burned his throat on the way down. He felt alive, more alive than he'd ever felt before. Next, he ate the rest of the raw meat before tossing the bare bones to the side. The elk should have been a week's worth of food, but it had barely lasted him half a day. He tried not to think about what that meant.
"Where am I going?"
he wondered instead. Thus far he'd just walked, letting his legs carry him whither they would. Here, for the first time since he'd left Night's End, he felt like he had a choice, that he was at a crossroads in his life. Henry was a Westerner, and now he was at an important border between kingdoms. The Northern Kingdom was on the other side of the pass. Alternatively, if he crossed the frozen stream, which was known as the Snake River, he would be in the east. At the present there was a tenuous peace amongst the Four Kingdoms, but that didn't mean you could always expect safe passage across borders, especially between the east and west, where tensions were always high.
"I could turn back," he thought. "Go back to Night's End. No one will recognize me now. I can start a new life. I can be anyone I want to be. That's not what Mother wanted for me. It's my life. Am I really arguing with myself? Mother, are you there?"
"I am here, child."
"Mother."
"You have done well, sweetness."
Her voice was the same as before, like an echo in his head, but softer now, as if it was fading. Henry didn't want it to fade.
"I haven't done anything."
"You left your home. That is something."
He'd never thought of it that way.
I think I might go back,
Henry thought to her.
It is your choice, she returned, and he could tell it's not what she wanted him to do.
Is it?
Yes. Fate will smooth out the wrinkles, regardless of what you decide. You can go back, live a simple life, a long life, a good life with no regrets.
But not an important life,
Henry thought, reading between the lines.
A good life is still important. The life I paved for you will be a lonely one. I will not force you.
Which implied that she could force him if she wanted to, even from the grave. His mother was dead, but not irrelevant, he realized. Suddenly, the path under his feet was as obvious as the mountains that flanked him.
I will go north, he thought to her.
There was no response. His mother was already gone. The pass was straight and narrow, a sliver of grey sky pouring mist down from above. The mountains on each side were like the shoulders of giants, jostling for position. The ice-sheathed river groaned beneath his heavy trod, but didn't crack. It was thick and strong.
Like me, Henry thought.
Though he felt a tingle of fear running along his skin, it wasn't like before, when it used to consume his every thought, making him hide from his tormentors. He didn't know what the North held for him, but he would face the future head on. Some instinct gave him pause, and he stopped, tilting his head back and sniffing the air. A faint odor tickled his nostrils. Smoke and sweat. A sound pricked his ears, so distant it might have been from another land entirely. Without thinking, he dove for the ice, feeling the whoosh of air zip past the space where his head had occupied only a moment earlier. The arrow whistled just high, its sharp downward angle slamming the sharp tip and half of the shaft into the ice. Henry stared at the black shaft, which twanged back and forth as it settled.
I'm under attack.
The thought, though true, startled him. He was no fighter, having avoided the constant scraps that boys tended to engage in while growing up, trying to best each other. Running and hiding was his preferred method of dealing with such conflicts. And yet running was the furthest thing from his mind now. Rage swelled up inside him, as hot and thick as boiled tar, shooting strength into his bones, power into his muscles, adrenaline into the blood rushing through his veins. He didn't want to run, not any more. He wanted to fight. The moment he made the decision, everything seemed to slow down, time coalescing into a focused window of light through which Henry looked, seeing the world like he'd never seen it before. The next arrow came in lower, but Henry was already rolling away, watching the dart's path, retracing it back to its source. A shadowy cleft in the mountains. A cave, perhaps, or at least a crawl space large enough for a human. Finishing his roll, he pushed to his feet, charging for the edge of the frozen river, where a steep cliff flanked the waterway. Another arrow ripped past, sliding against his shoulder and slicing a shred of fabric from his shirt. He was prepared for the next dart, snatching it from the air with hands that were too big to be his, and yet were. With a roar that sounded inhuman to his ears, he snapped the shaft in half, tossing the shattered pieces aside. He reached the cliff, momentarily protected from his attackers. He breathed. He raged. He marveled at his own poise, wondering at how he had caught an arrow from mid-air. If he hadn't been the one to perform such a feat, he would have believed it impossible. Suddenly the impossible seemed not only possible, but a foregone conclusion.
I will defeat them. I will.
He started climbing, his bare feet and hands finding purchase on rocks that, to the naked eye, appeared unclimbable. When he reached the lip, he peered over the embankment, zeroing in on that dark space from where the arrows had originated. Men were pouring from the shadows, gripping swords and spears, charging down the mountainside. They wore thick wool coats and heavy trousers as their dark boots pounded across the sloped terrain, kicking up powdery snow. 6, 7, 8, a dozen, 2 more. 14 men, bandits. trained killers who slaughtered their victims and took all they had. These infamous raiders give this very pass its name.
I have never fought before,
Henry thought. Unless, of course, he counted the times he'd been cornered in the alleys of Night's End. Those encounters always ended in black eyes and bloodied noses. This time he felt no fear. With a powerful pull of his arms, he threw himself over the cliff and sprinted toward his enemy. Most of the men stopped, shocked by the unexpected attack. They weren't used to such willing prey. Several, however, continued running, smiles curling their lips, their dark eyes gleaming with anticipation. Still Henry ran, closing the distance rapidly. The first raider approached, spear held outward, aimed at Henry's heart. Henry blinked, and the world slowed once more, until he could see the way the spear bounced up and down with each of the man's steps, until he could see the individual drops of snow melt dripping from his chin, the way the sunlight reflected off the whites of his eyes. The man cried something unintelligible, shoving his spear forward. Henry slapped it away with naught but his hand, swinging his other hand, which was now curled into a fist, in a round arc. His knuckles slammed into the man's face, and he heard an audible crack as bones broke. The man's nose, his cheekbones, perhaps his jaw. The bandit went down like he'd been struck by lightning, unleashing a high-pitched howl of agony. The rest of the men stopped, their mouths agape, staring at their comrade writhing in the snow. Henry stared, too, in awe of what he'd done. And then he bent down slowly and retrieved the man's spear. He had never used one before, and his newfound instincts offered no assistance. He raised the spear and broke it over his knees, throwing the jagged pieces to each side.
"You want to play, stranger?"
one of the bandits, a thick-chested man with a heavy red beard, said. He wore a red scarf around his head, something that seemed to set him apart from the other men, whose clothing was all dull greys and browns. Their leader, perhaps.
"Nobs, Ogban, Steppers. Take him."
Three men moved forward. One was significantly taller than the others, and yet Henry realized he was just as tall, easily able to look the man in the eyes, which were narrowed and focused. The other two were shorter, aye, but muscly and battle-scarred. A few weeks earlier, Henry would have run at the sight of any of these men. Not any more. The tall man spun a sword in a graceful arc, like he'd done it a thousand times. The other two prodded with spears, moving in on the flanks.
"The swordsman is trying to distract me," Henry thought.
So instead he faked left and then charged right, slipping past the reach of the spear before the wielder had time to react. He smashed his forearm into the man's throat, sweeping out his legs with his foot. Gasping, the man went down. The shuffling of feet announced the other spearman's arrival from behind. Henry ducked, using his thick body as a catapult, throwing the man, spear and all, over his shoulder. Screaming, the bandit tumbled down the hill, unable to arrest his fall as he slipped over the cliff and down to the ice-covered river below. Henry knew he'd injured his first two foes badly, but this third one was almost certainly dead. Something about the difference took his breath away. Not in a bad way, however. If anything, it excited him. The power was intoxicating. He controlled life and death, his own, these men's. As the taller man charged, sweeping his sword back and forth, something snapped inside Henry. He was fire. He was fury. He was blood and ash and bone, and above all else, he was death. He roared, and the sound seemed to cut through the cold like thunder. The man's eyes widened like full moons, and Henry could see the fear in them. It didn't come naturally to this man's face, the way it always had to Henry's. No, this was a new emotion for this man, who was used to being feared, not the other way around. He skidded to a stop, dropping his sword, but it was too late. It was too late for all of them. Henry leapt forward, raking a clawed paw across his foe's face. It wasn't a punch, not exactly, and yet the man's face split open, lines of blood appearing. Henry didn't think about what he was, what he'd become. The entirety of his being narrowed to a single emotion. Bloodlust. He crushed the tall man beneath his feet, tore into the other two downed men with his teeth, ravaging their flesh, tearing it open. Human blood dripped from his jaw, but he didn't care, wasn't disgusted by it. He was the apex predator, and this man was his prey. With a snarl, he planted his feet and threw himself up the slope, where the remaining 10 raiders were already in full retreat, led by their red-scarfed leader. He closed the gap between them in mere seconds, swiping his hands across backs and chests and faces, clamping his teeth on unprotected throats. He killed them all, until only one remained. The leader's back was to the wall, his weapons cast aside. He held his hands out in front of him in surrender, a plea for mercy. Henry wasn't in a forgiving mood. When it was finished, blood marred the whiteness of the mountain slopes, crimson pools and rivers. Henry was in denial. Not about the killing. No, he'd definitely done that. But about what he'd become. He refused to accept the sharp white claws flashing on either side, the thick, dark shadows of fur brushing past. He refused to believe the sharp fangs brushing against the edges of his lips. Awkwardly, he pulled a pair of black boots off the largest of the dead raiders, balancing them between paws without the luxury of opposable thumbs. He draped another man's blood-soaked trousers and shirt over his broad shoulders. The tall man's. He walked and walked and walked, northward bound. Eventually he was Henry again, a man grown, a man with something dark inside him. He traded his own too small, tattered clothes for the ones he'd stolen, not even bothering to clean off the blood. He pulled on the black boots, which barely fit, pressing tight against his toes. Then he kept walking.
3 months later. The adrenaline and bloodlust had faded long ago, leaving Henry empty, cold, and alone. Surviving was easy for him now. The icy wind didn't seem to touch him, never breaching his thick skin and hair. Hunting was second nature, and he never hungered, despite his voracious appetite. When there was no water, he simply crunched down on the snow, letting it melt on his tongue. Thus far, to his relief, he hadn't encountered another human, neither friend nor foe.
"It is better this way,"
Henry thought, lumbering along in the snow, which was knee-deep now. For 3 months he'd remained in human form.
"Did I imagine the change before?"
he wondered from time to time. He couldn't deny the truth, however, just as he couldn't deny that his mother had finally, at long last, abandoned him for good. He spoke to her often, in the dark throes of night, but he received no answer.
"Have I disappointed you, Mother?"
Henry asked. He didn't need her to respond to know that he had. Even as his mother was condemned by her own people, her own king, she'd preached peace.
"I'm a murderer. Nothing about that is peaceful. I defended myself. I saved myself and rid the world of bad men. How can that be wrong?"
It was an argument he had often, one that neither side had yet won. He froze, his instincts flaring. A hearty aroma breached his nostrils. Smoke, with the hint of something roasting, quail or pigeon, perhaps. His ability to discern scents with exactness had long ago ceased to amaze him. He paused, considering what to do. If he stumbled upon another group of bandits, there could be more violence, and then... he didn't want to think about it. On the other hand, they could be a peaceful camp, and he might make friends.
"I won't have to be alone any more."
He gritted his teeth and set his jaw, and moved in the direction of the smoke. After a while, he could see the smoke as well as smell it, the tendrils of grey and black curling over the crest of a snowy hill. Eager now, he lengthened his strides and covered the remaining distance. He stopped, surprised by what he saw. There was no small camp, no bandits, no caravan of northern merchants. But there was a castle, its grey walls and ramparts rising above a broad sprawl of tightly packed houses and structures, most of which had chimneys spouting smoke.
"Where am I?" he wondered,
trying to recall whether he'd ever seen a map of the northern kingdom. Of course, everyone who lived in Night's End knew that Blackstone was the westernmost northern city, nestled on the opposite side of the Bay of Bounty. Gearhert was a possibility, the border castle that was the last line of defence before Raiders Pass. But that seemed unlikely. He'd been travelling for months. Certainly he'd gone further than that. The northern capital, Castle Hill, on the other hand, was more toward the centre of the realm, on the edge of the enormous frozen lake. Henry scanned the landscape, but didn't see any lake.
"Of course not. I haven't travelled nearly far enough to reach Castle Hill."
Then where? Did it even matter? Henry knew he didn't belong here, with these people. Did he? He was a foreigner, for one. Secondly, he was dangerous.
"I don't want to hurt anyone. Never again. Not even to protect yourself? Not even to protect someone else?" Roth, he was tired of arguing with himself. Before his mother was executed, he'd never had to make decisions like this on his own. She was truth. She was the answer.
"Mother, why won't you answer me?"
"I'm here, child." His heart flipped.
"Why did you leave me?"
"I did not. I was only away for a while."
"Away where? Where are you?"
"In a better place. I can see everything more clearly now. The truth of my prophecies. How the fate-marked will arise, how they will move like pieces on a chessboard, changing everything.
You have a role to play too, son." "What if I don't want it? What if I just want to be Henry? What if I just want to be normal?"
"That is your choice, sweetness. I will love you the same. But, son, you will never be normal, and you shouldn't want that."
Henry thought about it. He knew she was right. How could he be like everyone else after what he'd done?
"What did you do to me?"
"I protected you."
It was true. Without the spell she'd cast on him, he would never have survived the cold, nor the raiders who'd attacked him through the pass. And if he'd stayed in Night's End,
they would have killed you, son. Because of me. I'm sorry.
"Mother?"
"Yes, child."
He knew he was a man grown, but it didn't bother him that she still referred to him as child. He would always be her child, he knew.
"Mother, I don't want to hurt anyone else."
"Then don't."
He flinched, taken aback by the simplicity of her response. No, it was more than that. It was like he'd been slapped. All this time he'd assumed that the things he'd done were some kind of natural instinct he had now. Not a choice. Not something he could help. Because if it had been a choice...
"I killed them."
"They would have killed you."
It was true, but he could have let some of them escape. They were trying to escape.
"They were bad men. They would have killed again. They deserved to die."
"But what if I lose control again?"
"Don't." He sighed.
"I wish you were here. I need you to tell me what to do."
"No."
The wind dusted his face, as if she'd echoed his sigh.
"You do not. Look how far you've come. You do not need me. Not any more."
Her words gave him strength, and though Henry realized she'd left him once more, he didn't feel scared. He started down the hill toward the castle village. Unlike the cities in the west, which were surrounded by impenetrable walls, the northern village was unprotected. Only the grey castle had fortifications. In the event of an invasion, the commoners were apparently left to fend for themselves. Henry literally walked into town, unquestioned, unnoticed, as if it was an everyday occurrence. Perhaps it was. The villagers continued going about their business. A washerwoman hauled a cart laden with heaping mounds of dirty clothes. Her arms were thick and muscled, and she used no beast of burden to pull the load. Breath misted from her lips as she grunted from the strain. Henry passed a man with stacked cages full of white, brown, and red chickens. The man opened one, grabbing the fowl by the neck as it flapped and scratched. With a quick wrenching motion, He snapped its neck and the bird went limp. Hunger gnawed at Henry's stomach, though he'd eaten not long ago. A loud, booming voice called from up ahead, shouting to the passers-by. A soldier, his dull armour grey and bearing the cracked but not broken shield sigil of the North. Beside him sat a scribe at a wooden table, with a long roll of curling parchment on which he was writing with a feathered quill. A crooked line of men extended outward from the table. They were a miserable lot, wearing raggedy clothing and unkempt beards. Several of them smoked ragweed pipes. None of them spoke, their eyes downcast, as if fixated on their time-worn boots. "They're becoming soldiers," Henry realized, just as the message from the caller clarified in his ears.
"War has been declared across the four kingdoms. Join the king's army and earn 2 shields a day and a hot meal. None shall be turned away."
2 shields a day didn't sound like a lot to Henry, but clearly these men were desperate for it, their eyes seeming to light up whenever the caller announced that part.
"Oh, you there," the soldier called, pointing in Henry's direction. "You're a brawny fella. What's your name?"
Henry turned to look behind him to see who the soldier was speaking to. There was no one there. He turned back and said,
"Me?"
The soldier laughed.
"Hi, you! I'm..."
He almost said Henry, but his true name seemed to get caught in his throat. He coughed.
"I'm... who am I?"
Was he a loner, destined to tramp through the icy tundra of the North, surviving off the land? Or could he live here, or in another village? His mother was right. He didn't need her. Not any more. He could control what he was. Who he was.
"I don't need to change again. I don't. I can just be me. Not Henry, no. He died with my mother. But this other person. Strong. Capable. A survivor."
He thought of the bloody footprints he'd left in the snow through Raiders Pass, broad, clawed, deep. And then he thought of the dead man's boots he now wore, slightly too small, oily black, warm.
"My name is Bear Blackboots," he said, "and I am no fighter. Good luck with your recruiting."
He walked on, ignoring the soldiers' calls. 3 years later, circa 355. Bear Blackboots was happy in the northern city he'd learned was called Walburg. Situated well east of Castle Hill, nearly halfway to the border castle of Darin, Walburg was a peaceful city with hard-working folk who preferred to keep their heads down and their backs bent. Although, just as his mother had prophesied, war and violence had broken out across the four kingdoms, in this small castle village Bear felt safe. He'd built a life here. Year after year he made a living as a hunter, traipsing through the woods and using his unique set of skills to take down elk and moose, and even the occasional ice bear, though killing the latter sometimes felt so awful Bear would sleep for days after, refusing to come outside. The meat and pelts sold for enough shields to keep Bear sheltered and clothed. After the first year, Bear had even saved enough coin to purchase a companion, a trusty old wolfhound he named Sir. Sir had grey and white speckled fur, one black ear and one white, and 4 paws that looked as if they were wearing white socks. Bear had no need of a hunting dog, but Sir did his best to help him chase down prey on their daily jaunts, seeming to relish the thrill of pursuit. They went everywhere together, until people almost began to identify them as a single entity. Now Sir nuzzled against the back of Bear's hand as he approached Kirby Soup, a tavern owner famous for the various rich, aromatic soups he concocted.
"They'll warm you from head to toe," he regularly proclaimed.
"What do you have for my stew today?" Soup asked.
Sir barked and bounded up to Soup, his tail wagging faster than a hummingbird's wings. Soup chuckled and scratched the hound under the chin. At first, Soup had been aloof to Sir's antics, but as the hound did, he eventually wore the man down. Now they were best friends.
"Half a quail and half a stone of moose meat," Bear said.
The round-bellied man narrowed his eyes.
"What happened to the other half?"
Bear rubbed his stomach. Soup's eyes, which were as rich and brown as the stews he created, widened.
You ate all of it?
Bear gestured to Sir.
With help.
Soup shook his head in amazement.
Never seen an appetite the likes of yours. Well, now you have,
Bear said, smiling broadly.
What price? You have to ask. It's robbery, I tell you,
Soup said, but he quickly counted out the required coins and passed them over.
You're lucky you get the friend's discount. Robbery,
Soup muttered again, accepting the package of wrapped meat. His complaints were all for show. Bear knew, as his friend had confided in him a long time ago. Soup didn't want his other vendors to get the idea that he was soft. Jingling the coins around in his pocket, Bear said,
Hope today's soup has them lining up. Sir!
Obediently, the hound gave Soup a final lick before following behind, nearly tripping Bear as he trotted around his feet. Bear's next stop was the cobbler, a squinty-eyed fella who never seemed to look anyone in the eye. He went by Cobb, just as most people in town used their occupation as a title of sorts. Except for Bear, of course, whose name was unique enough that everyone just called him Bear.
Morning, Cobb,
Bear said, letting in a gust of icy wind as he opened the door to the shop.
Shut the damn door,
Cobb said, staring at Bear's left temple. Bear had already closed the door, but he didn't try to point that out to the cobbler. Nor did he point out that every customer had to open the door to enter the shop. Cobb had never been particularly rational.
What?
Cobb growled. It was a relatively nice growl, for him anyway.
What's that?
He gestured to Sir, squinting in the hound's general direction.
My dog. Mangy mutt,
the cobbler muttered. Though Sir was anything but mangy, his fur thick and well-groomed.
Should wait outside where he belongs.
Bear ignored him. The man was all bluster, as cold as a northern winter.
Need a new pair of boots,
Bear said instead.
Again?
The cobbler pretended to sound annoyed, though Bear had gotten good at discerning the greedy gleam in the man's narrow eyes. Bear was one of his best customers on account of all the walking he did.
Same size. Same make.
Colour.
Bear played along, as he always did.
Perhaps brown this time. Or blue. Aye, blue. No, wait, I've got it. Black. Yes, black will do.
Are you pissing around with me?
Cobb asked.
Yes. Never.
Fine, black it is. Take off your boots and let me measure your feet.
Measuring was also unnecessary, as Bear's feet had stopped growing the same time the rest of him had. Even still, he was the largest man in town, both by height and weight. Every time a recruiting party came through Wahlberg, he was forced to hide in the woods for fear of being made to join the army. Thus far it was by volunteer only, but Bear suspected that would eventually change as the war dragged on. Lord Briar, the possessor of the large grey castle from which Wahlberg got its name, was a known lackey of King Garrick, and would almost certainly uphold any laws passed at Castle Hill. Bear let the thought slip away, and grudgingly shucked off his boots, peeled off his socks, and sat on a rustic, termite-gnawed bench. Sir stayed by the door, his tail between his legs. Once Cobb had tried to smack him with his cane, and the dog had a long memory.
"I'll give you a trade-in value of half a new pair,"
Cobb announced, hobbling over. It was the same thing he always said. The cobbler would harvest the leather and soles from the old pair.
Sounds fair,
Bear said.
Course it is.
The grey-haired man squatted and inspected one of Bear's enormous feet, which were coated in a dark layer of hair. Cobb cringed, like he always did. Then, using a piece of leather marked with various measurements, he calculated the size, width, length, and height, shaking his head and muttering with each one.
The damn giant you are.
Thanks for noticing,
Bear said.
What was that?
Nothing.
Then shut your trap.
At the door, Sir whined loudly.
You too, mutt,
Cobb growled. Sir sat on his haunches and went quiet. The man went back to measuring, triple-checking everything, though nothing had changed since the last time.
You heard about them Southron savages?
He asked suddenly, squinting up at Bear.
You know, the ones with the strange marks.
Bear flinched like he'd been hit in the face.
You stupid or something?
Cobb said.
No, I haven't heard. What marks?
The man pulled on one of the hairs on Bear's foot as if testing its strength.
Sal gossip and rumours, but there are those who are saying a couple of babies have been born in Calypso with markings on their skin. Something's wrong with them, that's for damn sure. Tain't natural.
Bear's heart pounded out a steady rhythm, slightly faster than before. He recited dozens of his mother's prophecies in his mind. Prophecies about the fate marked. Prophecies he hadn't thought about in years.
You say these marked babies are only in the south?
Didn't say that. Just that the first ones were there. 'Twas one in the west, too, but old King Loren, the bastard, had the child killed. His red priestesses said the creature was evil, a demon or the like.
The Furies?
Call them what you like.
They killed one of the fate marked. The same fools who'd killed his mother. The king. The Furies. Wrath. What did that mean for his mother's prophecies? According to her, the fate marked would help end the war and bring about peace. But how could they do that if they were being murdered as babes?
Did the Southrunners kill the marked babies too?
Nah, the man said. They're worshipping them or something. The Easterners have one too.
And the North?
The man laughed.
Too cold here, he said,
nodding firmly, as if that explained everything. Bear considered all the information, as well as the source. Cobb was a crazy old cook, but he didn't make things up. Embellished, perhaps. Could it really be true? Had the fate marked his mother had spoken of so often finally arrived? And if so, what would it mean for the war?
What does it mean for me?
Nothing.
I am happy here. It's not my concern.
The lie was bitter on his tongue, more so because he hadn't spoken to his mother in over a year.
I'll have your boots ready first thing tomorrow,
the cobbler announced, pulling Bear away from his thoughts.
That soon?
Bear feigned astonishment.
I'm a master cobbler, you dolt. Course they'll be ready that soon.
Bear pretended not to hear the insult. In his 3 years since arriving, he'd learned how to play all the games required to get by in Wahlberg.
Will you accept half the coin in advance?
I suppose I could,
the bootmaker said. The greedy glint was back. Bear handed over 12 shields, and the man snatched them up, stuffing them in a pocket.
The rest is due upon receipt of your boots.
I will bring it tomorrow morning.
He opened the door, and Sir scampered out ahead of him. Just as he shut it behind him, he heard Cobb shout,
"Shut the damn door!"
30 years later, circa 385. The war dragged on into its third decade. According to rumour, the fighting was particularly intense at Raiders Pass, where King Loren's army was pushing hard, 10,000 riders strong. The Easterners were gathering near the Razor, preparing to attempt an assault on Darin. It was said that in the south the battles were even bloodier, with the Calypsians riding dragons into battle, slaughtering their enemies at will. More than anything else, however, people loved to talk about those bearing skin marks. Just the other day Bear had heard about a man in the east who could supposedly shoot arrows from his fingertips, 10 at a time. Arrow-marked, he was being called. Grudgingly, Bear added him to the list he kept. The list already had 12 other names on it, though 4 of them were crossed out, dead, 2 murdered as babies in the west by Furies who still considered the marked to be demons, and 2 killed in battle. The latter pair had been Southrunners, worshipped and revered, and then sent to die. The 9 known living fate marked were spread across all 4 kingdoms, just as his mother had said they would be. Even the North had 2 of them. 1 was stone-marked, a brute with impenetrable flesh, who could crush foes with his bare hands. He'd been sent to Raiders Pass, where he was almost single-handedly holding the enemy at bay. The other was a woman whose speed was unsurpassed. She wielded a blade with such quickness she could supposedly block arrows with its edge, cutting them to pieces. She'd been sent to Darin to hold the border. Neither of them had been given a chance. According to northern law, those bearing marks belonged to the crown. Though they were treated like royalty, showered with unimaginable wealth and abundance, at the core they were naught but slaves. Most of the other fate-marked were also participating in the war, in one way or another. Though his mother's prophecies had said they would bring about peace, violence seemed to follow them wherever they went.
"What is the point of it all?"
Bear often wondered. On numerous occasions over the years, Bear had considered whether to seek these extraordinary people out, try to talk to them, find out how he could help them.
"Their fates will be yours. To help them is good."
The last line of his mother's poem played almost non-stop in his head, and yet something about the timing didn't feel right.
"Or maybe I'm just too content living a peaceful life in Walberg." "I am content," he thought,
rubbing behind Sir's ears as he stared into the flickering flames of the hearth fire. This was Sir Number 3, the first two having passed on after long and happy lives. They were buried in a small plot behind Bear's cabin. Sir 3 released a sigh of contentment. He was getting old too, his hair thinning, his movement slower. It wouldn't be long before Bear would have to bury another best friend, and seek out a new one. Some of his other friends were dying too. Soup had perished when a fever raged through the city. His two sons had carried on his business, but it wasn't the same. The soup was missing something. Heart, perhaps. Cobb had died, too, of old age, and now Bear's boots were growing worn and thin. Though his beard was longer and thicker, and the hair on his head more tangled, Bear didn't look a day older than when he'd arrived in Walberg, a fact that was beginning to be noticed by some of the townsfolk.
"Their hearts will fail, their lives will end, but yours will last. It will extend."
The meaning of the first two lines of his mother's poem, know her spell, were clear to him now. He suspected they always were, even if he didn't want to believe it. His life would be longer than most.
"Am I immortal? No, Roth, I will die as all men must, eventually. But am I truly a man?"
Bear was no longer scared of changing into his animal form. He could control the instincts that came along with it, choosing when to attack, when to hold back. He usually only allowed himself to change once or twice a year, roaming the forest with Sir by his side, hunting. Since that day in Raiders Pass, he had not killed another human.
"You can't stay here."
His hand froze on Sir's scalp. He hadn't heard that voice in over a decade, maybe longer. He'd stopped counting the years long ago. Now he pretended not to hear it.
"Sweetness?"
"No. No!
Henry!" "That's not my name,"
Bear growled. Sir whined at the outburst and scampered away, eyeing Bear warily.
"You will always be my son, my Henry."
"You're dead!"
Then, remembering he didn't need to speak aloud, echoed the thought in his head.
"You're dead."
"In the manner known to humans, yes."
"What other manner is there?"
"The manner known to gods."
"Wrath?"
"Wrath, absence, Orion, they are all the same being, the one, the creator."
Bear said nothing. He didn't know what to say after all these years.
"The people here will get suspicious. They will eventually come for you, turn on you. They don't like what they don't understand."
Bear already knew this. He hadn't delayed his departure out of ignorance or naivete, no. He'd stayed because the thought of leaving felt a little like dying.
"You know where you must go."
He did.
"When?"
"Immediately."
"What is in Castle Hill for me?"
The northern capital had always been his destination. He'd known this in his heart for years.
"Nothing. Everything. A new beginning. An old ending. Life. Death. Hope. Futility."
He chuckled. It was the only thing he could do.
"Is that all?"
"No. Fate is there, too.
That word again. Bear was beginning to hate it.
Mine?
Yes, yours. And others.
Bear sighed.